Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be providing an in-depth look at the embattled DOL fiduciary rule, including where are we now, what's next, and what other best practices firms should have in place currently regarding any investment recommendations being made and other services provided to retirement investors. To help guide us through this important topic and share some fantastic insights for our listeners, we welcome in an august panel of experts: Jason Berkowitz with the Insured Retirement Institute, David Kaleda with the Groom Law Group, and Jason Roberts with the Pension Resource Institute. The interview with Jason, and David was exceptional. And given the importance of the subject matter and the fantastic content produced, we structured this show as another installment of our Lessons from the Frontline series. We've talked about these shows before, but for some of our new listeners, the Lessons from the Frontline series focus on real life, tough to tackle subjects that other industry professionals and regulators have faced on the front lines of our industry. And if you're anything like me, you probably saw the headlines indicating the DOL fiduciary rule got stayed in August, but have been wondering, or maybe your colleagues have been asking, what exactly does that mean? So to help answer that question and many more, I know the best thing for me to do at this point is to get up and out of the way. And so with that, let's dive into the interview with Jason, and David. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be talking about one of the most pressing items that we've seen in the investment management space in 2024, and a topic area that has really received a lot of media attention. And while we're going to give an update on some of the things that have been happening in that space, I think we're also going to be, hopefully, especially with this distinguished panel, which I'll get to introduce here shortly, talking about a lot of best practices that I think even outside of some of the specific rulemaking that we've seen in this space recently, that compliance officers of all types are really going to be able to gain a lot of really valuable knowledge from. And more specifically, I'm talking about the area of ERISA and the Department of Labor fiduciary rule, which feels like at this point we're on some kind of zombie version of, given the number of rules that have come out over the past several years. But I am incredibly pleased to be joined by an incredibly distinguished panel of folks here, specifically David Kaleda, Jason Berkowitz, and Jason Roberts. David Kaleda is a principal with the Law Group. He has a broad range of experience on handling fiduciary matters impacting plan sponsors, investment, and other fiduciaries, record keepers, broker dealers, banks, insurance companies, and registrants of all different types. In December of 2011, Mr. Kaleda was appointed by the Secretary of Labor to the DOL's ERISA Advisory Council. He's a frequent speaker on these topics and someone that, again, has a wealth of knowledge that we're going to be tapping into today. We also have on today's show Mr. Jason Roberts. Jason is the founder and CEO of the Pension Resource Institute, a consulting firm that specializes in assisting financial institutions with ERISA and Department of Labor regulatory compliance and helping to deliver training, technical expertise, and practice management resources designed to help firms better serve retirement investors. He is also the founder and managing partner of the Fiduciary Law Center, also known as the Retirement Law Group, a law firm that is focused on providing actionable solutions to investment fiduciaries and plan sponsors. Finally, in 2021, he co-founded Group Plan Systems, an independent pooled plan provider for a growing number of pooled employer plans, or PEPs, in the space. Jason, welcome to the show. And in addition to Jason Roberts, we also have Jason Berkowitz. Jason Berkowitz is the Chief Legal and Regulatory Affairs Officer at the Insured Retirement Institute. He leads IRA's regulatory affairs team, which helps advocate for IRA member company priorities on major regulatory initiatives that are applicable to the lifetime income industry before federal and state policymakers, including the SEC, FINRA, the Department of Labor, the Treasury, the state insurance and securities departments, and managers. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for being so generous with your time to come on today's show. Really excited to dive into the conversation.
Thank you for having us.
As we get started, I think it's always helpful for our listeners, who many of whom I'm sure have probably seen some of these headlines over the last, I was going to say over the last year, but as we know, this has been something that's certainly been top of mind for a lot of folks in the space for quite a few years now. But I guess it might be helpful. Let's do a level set. Let's talk about the DOL. There was a DOL fiduciary rule, a Department of Labor fiduciary rule that was passed earlier this year. There's been some activity that has happened since its original passing. And so I think let's do a bit of a level set of kind of the rule that was passed and where are we now as it relates to that specific rule that was passed in the second quarter of this year.
So this is Jason Berkowitz. Again, thank you, Patrick, for having us. I guess let me just start with a quick overview of what the regulatory package is that was adopted earlier this year. It included four components. The first component is a change in the definition of who is a fiduciary under ERISA. And then the other three components were changes to what are called prohibited transaction exemptions, which are essentially the rules that ERISA fiduciaries have to follow in order to receive compensation for their services. And in effect, essentially the way that, at least for my organization and our members, we look at this final regulatory package as significantly expanding the reach of fiduciary status to reach almost any financial professional who interacts in any way with a retirement saver, and creates significant new burdens and hassles for those individuals in order to get paid. And so as a result of those concerns, we were part of the coalition of organizations that brought suit down in the Northern District of Texas earlier this year, challenging the validity of that regulation. Again, as it's a pending active litigation, I can't say too much about it, but I can share that procedurally so far, the district court has ruled in our favor in granting a stay of the regulation, meaning that while it was originally scheduled to take effect in September of this year, September 23rd to be precise, that did not happen and will not happen unless and until that stay is lifted or the litigation is otherwise resolved. But I will leave it to my fellow panelists to share their thoughts on the details of the litigation if they would like to share.
Yeah, maybe David or Jason would welcome your thoughts on the litigation in question.
Yeah, I guess I could chime in first. Again, thanks for having us. It's Dave Kalita from Grimm Law Group. And this is, we've been through this once before, right? The Department of Labor tried to do this back in 2016 and lost in 2018. The rule was vacated, so they took another shot at this. There are two cases pending, the one that Jason referred to, which is in which his organization is involved, and then there is also a separate case, both in Texas, different federal district courts. And at the core of the one is mostly a focus on the definition of investment advice and this expansion. And then the other focuses on both the definition as well as the implementation or changes to these prohibited transaction exemptions on which we all rely in this business to some extent. And that would include prohibited transaction exemption 2000-2002 or PTE 2002, as well as prohibited transaction exemption 8424, and then some others as well. And these were going to become effective soon. They would have been effective as of September 23rd of this year in part, and then the rest would have been effective in September 23rd of 2025. So both district courts stayed the effective date indefinitely. One case came down on July 25th and then another on July 26th. So at this point, we're still waiting to see how this will be resolved. There are really two tracks here. One is just this effective date stay, and the next track is the merits of the case, whether the DOL even has the authority to do this in the first place. So the DOL did file a notice of interlocutory appeal, which basically means they're appealing the stay at this point. And also all the parties have been working on a decision on the underlying regulation and exemptions. That's being put on hold so that the DOL can at least consider whether they're going to appeal. At this point, they've just noticed the court that they could appeal. Whether they do or not remains to be seen. Personally, I don't know if Jason Roberts has a different thought. I personally thought they weren't going to do an interlocutory appeal, that they would focus on the merits of the case. But at least at this point, they seem to be right now focusing on the effective date and the delay of that indefinitely.
Jason Roberts, you have any additional thoughts or other items? They certainly pretty well covered the nuts and bolts of where the litigation is at, but anything else to add on that specific part?
I think it's important to note that at least some of the things that we've heard in the marketplace and that need to be cleared up is, as Jason mentioned at the beginning, the part of the rulemaking package included amendments to privative transaction exemption PT 2002. The legacy 2002 is still on the books. Same with 8424. Sweeping changes to 8424 had been finalized but not yet effective. The legacy 8424 is still on the books. And then the definition of investment advice for determining what activities give rise to fiduciary status under ERISA and the tax code, that definition is still on the books. It's the definition that's been on the books since 1975, with the exception of that brief period where we did have that 2016 conflicts of interest regulation defining the term investment advice. But the reason I mention that is I think there has been a tendency for firms to dial back or feel like that the authority of the DOL writ large is being questioned. And I think it, at least from where I'm sitting, we've seen a steady uptick in more proactive enforcement, where the DOL traditionally investigates plans, right? And occasionally they would come up through the plan investigation and ask more questions of the service provider. But over the last few years, we've certainly seen more investigations of service providers, and particularly focused on prohibited transactions. I think it's, while we're in this interim period, firms need to be sure they're up to snuff with the rules that are on the books today, because I just don't think it's going to be long before a lot of agencies that have been challenged with rulemaking turn to focus more on enforcement of what's on the books. And we've already seen some of that coming into this new rule.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. And one, thank all three of you for walking our listeners through a current update on the litigation itself. And for those that are interested in going back and understanding what was in that rule proposal at a very granular level, we did here earlier in the year that helped to summarize that. So go back and listen to that interview with Fred Riesch from a little bit earlier in the year. But I think today, what you just alluded to there, Jason, I think is really helpful, because I think what we want to do also, in addition to providing the listeners with an updated idea of where some of the DOL fiduciary rule stands and the active litigation challenging it, but also probably a lot of folks are probably just sitting there and they've seen all these headlines come out and they're like, wait a minute, what exactly should I be doing now? Like, what rules should I be complying with and having an understanding of that? So maybe Jason Roberts, maybe I'll start with you. You started to really, I think, dig in there on what is the status quo. But it may be even taking a little bit of a step back. We had regulation from the mid-70s that kind of helped to initially shape some of this. If you could just talk maybe briefly about that, and then maybe start to dig into a little bit of what you're talking about, of what are, for firms to be able to execute compliance with PTE 2020-02 and other types of part, what advice would you give firms that are out there? So maybe let's start with the 75 regulation, and then we'll deal with that second piece.
Sure. And the 75 regulation was an out of the passage of ERISA. ERISA says there's three different ways one can become a fiduciary. The two that are most relevant to our listeners, your listeners here today, are investment discretion, exercising control over the management of plan assets, or investment advice. Discretion when you see it, right? It's, you don't just trip and fall into a discretionary relationship. Investment advice, though, means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So in 1975, we have the implementing regulations defining, among other things, what constitutes investment advice. It's a five-part test, but if you meet that five-part test and you're compensated, then you're considered a fiduciary. And by the way, this definition extends to IRAs and other non-ERISA plans through the tax code and its prohibited transactions. something I think that's important that a lot of people that we're going to need to appreciate as we get deeper into this conversation, so I'll at least put it out there now, is the for compensation prong is broadly construed. So if I'm a wealth management advisor and I have a client who has a 401k, it's held away with an employer with which I have no relationship, I'm not getting paid, I'm not the advisor or the record on that plan, but let's say every year I ask that individual to bring their 401k statement and we look at the funds available, we look at their investment objectives, et cetera, and I give them individualized advice on a regular basis. The fact that I'm getting paid financial planning fees or wealth management fees, even on taxable accounts, would satisfy that for compensation component. So the test is really whether or not I'm giving advice concerning the advisability of investing in securities or other property. I'm doing that on a regular basis, pursuant to an understanding, written or otherwise, that it will serve as a primary basis of that retirement investor's investment decisions. And it's individualized based upon the needs of that plan participant or IRA owner. And so I always tell our clients, let's cut through the chase from a practical perspective. What regulator allows you to give advice that's not? And if you're the only person sitting at that meeting with financial advisor, financial professional on your business card, you can bet that whatever comes out of your mouth or whatever you communicate in writing will be a primary basis of investment decisions. It really brings us back to this notion of regular basis. And it's unfortunate because to answer that simple question, what is the status quo with the new rules on hold? We revert to the status quo, or that operates to preserve the status quo. And the unfortunate position we're in, you not only have to look to 1974 definitions in ERISA, you have to look to the 75 regulation to know what investment advice is. But when it comes to assets in motion, whether it be rollovers or transfers, et cetera, then you also have to remember that in the context of PTE 2002, the DOL came out with a couple significant interpretations affecting that regular basis prong. And not only that, then you have to remember last spring in 23, a federal court, a district court, vacated part of that interpretation. So long story short, what it boils down to is if I'm giving run-of-the-mill advice within the same type of an account and nothing, no assets are in motion, then I apply the five-part test to determine whether or not I'm serving in a fiduciary capacity. If I am recommending a rollover, for example, then I can, or let's just say an IRA to IRA transfer, DOL interpretations that remain on the books are that if I'm giving regular basis advice on the IRA that I'm recommending to be transferred, then the DOL will view the recommendation to transfer it as an extension of that pre-existing investment advice relationship I have. Problem is that recommendation to move the assets is generally where the financial conflict is, right? And thus the need for an exemption. But the DOL went on to say, that one wasn't a real surprise to me, at least anyway, but the other interpretation was, and it's significant because what it purported to establish was that regular basis can occur between two different plan types. So if I don't have a pre-existing fiduciary relationship, but I reasonably expect to have one in the, call it destination account, what it is I'm recommending, then the DOL would view that first piece of advice, the recommendation to actually set those assets in motion, as the beginning of my investment advice fiduciary relationship, and therefore any additional compensation or third-party payments received as a result of that initial recommendation would be swept in and would lead to the need for an exemption in most cases. The court disagreed, and now this is where we are today, that the court said you cannot establish that regular basis advice between two different plan types. So unless I have a pre-existing ERISA fiduciary relationship with you concerning your individual plan account that I'm recommending to be rolled over to an IRA, then I cannot, they will not establish between the two different plan types. So for now, if I am recommending an IRA to IRA, either a pre-existing ERISA or pre-existing fiduciary relationship or one post will make me a fiduciary for purposes of that recommendation. But if it's between an ERISA Title I plan and an IRA, for example, I must have the pre-existing fiduciary relationship before then the recommendation to move those assets will be considered fiduciary.
And Jason,
it's a lot to pack into an abbreviated period of time, but that's really what you have to fully appreciate to understand the status quo today.
Yeah. And I would just add that this is a significant change for the department. They had historically taken the position that rollover recommendations from a 401k to an IRA did not constitute investment advice for purposes of the five-part test. And they had actually put out an advisory opinion back in 2005 to that effect. That has been withdrawn. That's been sometimes referred to as the Deseret or Deseret opinion, but that is no longer on the books. I think, as Jason said, we have the ruling from the Florida court that new interpretation is not valid, but we also don't have the Deseret opinion any further to rely on. So I think we all think that it's likely that new relationships starting with a rollover recommendation probably is not investment advice. It's not quite as clear as if we still had Deseret still in place.
Yeah, I would also add that I would echo that in that I'd echo two things or say two things. One is it is the middle district of Florida. It's supposedly the law of the land, but it's still possible that another federal district court could come up with a different answer. So we would have a split at that point. So I'm not sure all firms are comfortable thinking that we're going to stop doing any kind of 2002 compliance, even on rollover recommendations, if we've done it before, just because of that case. But I know one in particular that is, but I know many that are not. The other thing is, I've certainly seen a trend in the marketplace where firms that I would argue are more retail oriented, meaning individuals, particularly IRAs, things like that, are getting a lot more into the ERISA space, meaning they want to provide services to plan at the plan level or to participants in those plans, as well as individuals. So there's this increasing trend where advisors, either individual advisors or at the firm level at least, they are fiduciaries to the plan. So that would suggest then that even the Middle District of Florida case doesn't apply either in that way at all. So mm-hmm. I think unfortunately, it's a little unsettled right now exactly how comfortable we can get with some of these.
Yeah, and I think one quick point to add there, this is Jason Roberts again. The Deseret letter also said that if you cause a participant to take a distribution, if you use the authority that makes you a fiduciary to cause a participant to take a distribution and recommend that they reinvest the proceeds in a way that causes you to earn additional compensation, then you may be engaging in a prohibited transaction under ERISA. And so that was the sort of gray cloud that all of our clients lived under from 2005 on. It was uncertain then, it's uncertain now. I do agree with David. I think few firms are ready to, for lack of a better term, stop over complying where they may be over complying today, unless if they can do it, keep the advisor, financial professional in the same routine, doing the same analysis that they need to do to satisfy FINRA and the SEC, but then instruct the software to stop short of generating the rollover disclosure that details why you believe it's in the client's best interest. We're starting to see some firms do that because, in my estimation as a former litigator defending financial institutions, when that piece came into PT 2002, that really struck me between the eyes, because it's always Monday morning quarterbacking when the market tanks and so forth. And in the spirit of complying with just that which is required, if you can say for certain, for example, we have no pre-existing relationship with this individual, this is truly the first interaction we're having, then if a firm can isolate those transactions, not include them in their retrospective review, not deliver that, the document I think contains the most exposure, which is the rationale for the rollover, then I'm seeing firms starting to ask those questions. But it really boils down to the number of financial professionals and if it's significant, whether or not the software can accommodate a slight change in output, but the advisor, the financial professional, can keep doing the same thing they were for the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to remember that while 2002, the preamble did arguably expand the definition. Whether that is enforceable or not is another question in light of the ASA case. But the five-part test still applies, right? So at the end of the day, in a typical brokerage account, if you walk through the five-part test, maybe you can make arguments like regular basis don't exist. If that's the case and you're not providing ongoing advice, then the recommendation to do the rollover isn't, even under that interpretation, going to be investment advice. And there were firms who got comfortable with that ever since 2020, where I think, I know I saw it in firms where if they were holding themselves out to be a trusted advisor, and really at the end of the day, particularly like in the wealth management space and things like that, where they wanted to be viewed as providing advice at the end of the day, and it was just a matter of how they got compensated, whether it was broker commissions or an assets under management fee, and that was the main distinction. I think they were inclined to say, okay, we're willing to say we're going to be a 2002 fiduciary per the preamble, but that's certainly not across the entire marketplace, and there were a lot of providers who were willing to say, hey, under the five-part test, we don't provide it on a regular basis, where there's no mutual understanding or something along those lines. So that still applies today.
And I think it's also important, I would just add, that a lot of people are familiar with the distinctions in the securities world between a broker-dealer and an investment advisor, and where as a broker-dealer, you can provide incidental advice in conjunction with your brokerage services without triggering the requirement to register as an investment advisor and become a fiduciary under the 40 Act. In the DOL world, they have rejected that bifurcation. They have essentially tried to argue that if you are providing investment advice, whether it is your primary business or it's just an add-on, we're going to argue that should trigger fiduciary status under ERISA. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why the court in 2018 rejected the previous version, because the court there determined that the Congress, in enacting ERISA and structuring it the way it did, intentionally structured this as providing investment advice for a fee, which is not the case for a brokerage relationship where you're being paid for your brokerage services. And if you happen to offer some advice as an addition, you're not actually getting paid for that. So you could provide that advice and not get compensated if the client doesn't execute the recommended transaction. Mm.
It's an interesting point. Jason Roberts, were you going
to
add anything?
I had one thing I've been hesitant to even bring up, but you can tell us if you want to go deeper. Just responding to something that David mentioned earlier, because a lot of our clients at Pension Resource Institution and Pension Resource Institute and fiduciary law are really in that space. They're in the plan advisory market. They're out recruiting professionals that have deep knowledge of serving plans, and they're providing fiduciary services at the plan level. But if you look at that 2002 interpretation, it talks about having an investment advice relationship with the individual concerning his or her tax favored account, I think is the term they use. And so I'm not ready to say that it's settled that having a plan level fiduciary relationship, because I give advice on the core funds and the, you know, qualified default investment alternative or things like that, that I have that individualized relationship with any participant. Certainly if I'm managing accounts or I'm holding myself out as being providing regular basis advice as part of that service to participants, then yeah, I think we satisfy it. But just a plan level, what a lot of people call 321 or 338 relationship, I don't know that, I'm not ready to say that makes you an ERISA fiduciary with the way the DOL extends that regular basis interpretation. I think there's still daylight between the two interpretations.
I definitely agree with that. And I know with my clients, we try to separate out who's doing what with regard to the plans, and, you know, at least so the individuals involved. But where it gets blurry and it's not, it is where in this small business environment, let's say it's a group of doctors. More often than not, the physicians, one or the owner of the practice or the two or three partners of the practice, they're the non-plan clients. And you provide advice or discretionary management to their IRAs and taxable accounts, et cetera. And then you're like, hey, and you could set up a cash balance plan, and we could provide the management over here. So then and we can get you all these tax savings. Now, of course, we have to cover some other people because we'll never pass discrimination testing and things like that. But all of a sudden, that starts to look like I'm advising individuals too. So there's always this, but if you could really separate the two, I totally agree. It's just sometimes in real life, it's hard to make that, but I'm sure Jason, as I would, we would be advising them to be very clear about drawing the line.
Definitely an arrow on the side of caution, right? Consider you are, but you're not.
Yeah. And I guess one, again, thank you to all three of you for providing, I think, a deep look into what is a incredibly complicated area and certainly has a lot of layers to it as far as what you need to do in order to make sure that the services that you're providing your clients specifically, that you're able to provide the right internal controls and make sure that you have the right kind of framework in place to ensure compliance with, again, the existing state of the law, which is a little bit hard to navigate around. I guess that leads me to, as we look to start to close up our conversation, I think a couple of the key areas that I would love to dig in with all three of you on include reviewing the full regulatory framework, right? Because mostly what we've been talking about today has been Department of Labor centric, I would say, but there's other regulatory frameworks that are out there that certainly continue to impact the space. And you all have alluded to those, but certainly I would love to, for the benefit of our listeners, I think it'd be great to go into what are some of the specific areas there. And then I'd love to get into, to wrap up our discussion fully, what's the state of enforcement look and what are you all hearing from firms out there and thinking about what's happening with the Department of Labor on this? Does the IRS get involved in that area at all? What kind of things happen there? And then certainly from the more investment-related regulators like the SEC or FINRA or others. Let's start by, I think, going back and taking a look at it. What the full regulatory framework and some of the related obligations there. And I'll kick it off to the panel, whoever wants to dive in on this one. I see Jason Berkowitz smiling, so maybe we'll pick on Jason to start here.
Yeah, I'm happy to kick us off here. From where we sit, the way we look at the overall regulatory framework is having really three main components and then one more that's in flux. So in addition to the Department of Labor regulations, we have the Securities and Exchange Commission, which back in 2019 adopted regulation best interest and formed CRS. Those took effect in 2020. Reg BI requires all broker-dealers and registered representatives to always act in their clients' best interest when providing investment recommendations without putting their own interests or the interests of their firm ahead. That includes a set of detailed disclosure obligations, obligations related to identification and mitigation of actual and potential conflicts of interest, as well as some other requirements. But those are really the most significant. You also have the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or NAIC, which in 2020 adopted updates to its existing model regulation. So since 2003, they've had a regulation that imposed a suitability standard with respect to annuity recommendations that had been updated a number of times between 2003 and 2015. And then in 2020, it was updated to impose a best interest standard rather than the suitability standard, and it was intentionally designed to align and conform as much as possible to regulation best interest in order to ensure consistency across the two regimes. That regulation at the NAIC is a model, so it does have to be individually adopted by each state in order to be effective. As of today, we are at 47 states, with two others pending, having proposals that are already pending, and the final one is on the cusp of introducing their proposal. So we're expecting that we'll see those get finalized within the next several months here. And though that regulation also imposes disclosure obligations, conflict of interest obligations, and so forth. In addition, the piece that I said is in flux is on the state securities side, where you have the North American Securities Administrators Association, or as we like to refer to it as the other NASA. They have a regulation that is really applicable broadly to broker-dealer conduct and unfair trade practices for broker-dealers, and they have a proposal pending that would modify that model to impose a best interest standard that aligns with Reg BI, as well as a very concerning and problematic menu of 8 options for states to choose from. So we're not sure where that's going to land. They're still in the process of evaluating comments. And so we're watching that closely to see where that may end up. But that's really, as I see it, the overall framework. And the Department of Labor has tried to argue that their 2024 rule aligns with Reg BI. They've even gone so far as to say anyone who's complying with Reg BI really shouldn't have any problems complying with our regulation. I call that, not sure there's a phrase I could use in mixed company for that, but I will say I disagree vehemently with that characterization.
Yeah, I think
a couple quick things. I think, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the deal, I agree with that. The deal has, they'll say, oh yeah, if you comply with Reg BI, you comply with this. But one thing is that the level and Reg BI compliance is so across the board, for one. Some is more rigorous than others, but the others, I don't think any of us want to deal well interpreting whether your compliance with Reg BI is good or bad. Obviously, that's FINRA SEC's job. Yeah, so that you have to take that with a grain of salt. And usually I get the question, I comply with Reg BI, won't that work? And I'm like, I don't know. It depends on how you comply with Reg BI. I can really tell you. But I don't, if I haven't helped you with Reg BI compliance, I don't know.
I think just related, what I would say, it's Jason Roberts again, is the differences when firms ask me about similar questions, and, hey, I'm already a fiduciary under the Advisors Act, and I'm complying with the Advisor Act interpretation in terms of standard of care and disclosure and so forth. The way I always try to get their attention is just to describe how the penalties, that the prohibited transaction penalties are, it's per se. Doesn't matter how well-intentioned you were, or in most cases, even how great of an outcome the client may have had. If you did X, you've engaged in a violation. So it's really per se liabilities, we'd say. But then the penalties are very formulaic. So if you've got a prohibited transaction, you get out of calculate. We know what the penalties are. And at a minimum, it's a disgorgement plus interest. So that can, if a firm is lulled into a sense of complacency because they feel like they're dotting I's and crossing T's with the SEC or whatever their other regulator is, if the DOL finds a pattern of non-exempt prohibited transactions, if you just start thinking about how much disgorgement plus interest since the inception of that transaction can a firm's cash flow support? It's quite literally bet the company stakes if firms flaunt or don't take the time to understand when these rules apply. And there are 3 core differences to this notion of if I'm complying with Reg BI or Advisors Act, I'm complying with 2002, for example. No, you've got a written fiduciary acknowledgement that must be provided in advance of any transaction that you're seeking coverage or exemption under 2002. And what that's submitting to is the highest standard of care under the law. You're saying on paper, when I provide investment advice to you, I am a fiduciary under ERISA and or the code as applicable. So that's a big difference. You've got the rollover playback that I mentioned earlier, where you're turning over sort of your notes. And I'm not just so jaded to think that it's your notes that are going to get you in trouble. It's what if I honestly overestimated the plan expenses or underestimated the IRA expenses? To what degree is that error then determined to be misleading? And now I'm in trouble with all of my regulators, right? It's a pillar of the impartial conduct standards for purposes of PTU 2002 that advice not be misleading. And it's also prohibited under other regulatory structures. And then the third component is this retrospective review, which as it stands today, we're operating under the legacy conditions of 2002, those that were finalized in 2020. It requires a retrospective review, which is an annual look back. It has to be reduced to a report and certified within 6 months of the close of that review cycle. And so part of that would, you could find non-exempt prohibited transactions. And when you do that, a self-correction requires, at least today, that you email the DOL and tell them about that and describe the failure and the correction that you implemented, and if any investment losses occurred, that you restored those losses, et cetera. And those are just three examples of things that are well above and beyond Reg BI or Advisors Act disclosure. And each of them comes with their own sets of risks.
And I would also add the two other things that are key distinctions, or maybe three, actually. One is, if you're a fiduciary under Title I of ERISA, which is what covers the 401k space, you are not only subject to penalties that could be issued by the administrative agency, but also to potential private right of action where a participant, a recipient of the advice, or even a class of recipients, if they could find a basis to bring a class action, could actually sue you for private damages beyond what the Department of Labor could do. In addition, the amended versions of the PTEs that we've been talking about included a provision under which an individual financial professional or a firm, broker-dealer firm, for example, could lose the ability to rely on those exemptions for a decade, which is essentially putting you out of business, out of that business. If you or any part of your controlled group has engaged in conduct that resulted in certain types of felonies, pretty broad list of felonies, and not just domestically, but anywhere in the world, with the exception, I think, of six countries that are on our foreign adversaries list. And so that includes even taking those six out. You've got a lot of countries that don't necessarily believe in due process the way that we do. They define their crimes differently. And yet you could have somebody who's got no involvement in your retirement plan business here in the States who gets in trouble for something overseas, and all of a sudden you and your whole firm are out of this business. So that's pretty draconian. And then just one other point, which is another important distinction between an ERISA fiduciary and an investment advisor fiduciary, is the SEC rules under the 40 Act allow for consent by the client. So you provide disclosure to them. I may have a conflict of interest. Here it is. Here's all the information. The client can then say, okay, I understand. I still want to work with you. I still want to receive your recommendations and have you be my investment advisor. The ERISA structure does not allow for that. If you are a fiduciary and you have conflicts, you must follow the conditions that are set forth in an exemption, or you cannot provide those services and receive compensation for them.
Yeah, that's super helpful. David, did you want to add anything to that before we get into the
I think it's worth noting just what Jason said, is that DOL is desperately trying to get ERISA and its enforcement provisions to apply to more so than it does today, because the excise tax issue, while it's a very real issue, they don't have enforcement jurisdiction. That's the Treasury Department and IRS, where there's, at least for now, not as much activity. Theoretically, the DOL really just refers those cases. Their theory is they want to be in this space, notwithstanding all the efforts that these other regulators have made since 2016, when the first regulation, investment advice regulation, came out, and the best interest contract exemption, et cetera. So we've come a long way as an industry to address some of the issues that DOL and other regulators were worried about. But DOL, at the end of the day, they want that enforcement right more directly. Yeah, and the 2002, I will say the amendments, the one Jason pointed out with the criminal conviction, is a big deal, no doubt about it. But there were good things in the 2002 amendment. I'm not saying we shouldn't have shot it down as part of the litigation, but I think it's worth revisiting as an industry. Things like the expansion of the principal transactions. We don't need disclosures for IRA to IRA transfers. This whole self-correction thing is silly, because the DOL, at least to date, hasn't done all that much with it. And the fact that we can't use an exemption like this on robo-advice doesn't make a whole lot of sense, like pure robo-advice. So there's certainly, I just think it's fair to say that is something we might want to think about at some point. We might have to let it die now to allow for the litigation to be successful, but it is something we may want to revisit in the future as an industry, certainly.
Yeah, and I think that is, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I know certainly I had a lot of registered investment advisors that were very excited to not have to do any disclosures for the IRA to IRA rollover type situation. But I guess to close out our discussion here today, and would welcome your thoughts on the current state of enforcement. David, you alluded to a big chunk of it there and what can frequently happen with the referrals that come in. But maybe are there other, from either the IRS or the SEC side, are there other things that you're hearing or seeing on the enforcement front that would be useful for our listenership to hear?
So I think Jason hit it on the head earlier. The DOL is, they, in my experience, they're not really focusing on 2002 compliance, and that was intentional because they were trying to get everybody just to comply with it, and then they came out with their new reg and new amendments to the exemption. But I, just to give perspective, is that when our firm at any given time is probably working on 30 different Department of Labor investigations. If I would have said 20 years ago, I would have said 80, 90% of those at least would have been focused on plan sponsors. Now it's more, at least 50%, if not more, are focused on plan service providers. The DOL has a tendency to just focus on the actual ERISA covered plan issues because they have direct jurisdiction. If they see problems with IRAs, they'll refer them to the IRS, but we have never had the IRS do anything about it because I don't think they're set up for it right now. But it's very clear that the DOL does take enforcement seriously in the ERISA space from the provider's standpoint as well. For instance, I had a broker-dealer client, an SEC investigation ensued. There was the typical share class kind of stuff. And then they realized that there were third-party payments going to the brokerage firm and other things like that, which, and they were like, you can only get level compensation under ERISA, so how is this possible? And under the IRO, under the code. And we had to explain to them, there are exemptions that allow for this currently, that currently exist, 77-4, 75-1, others. And so we explained that, and they're like, I don't know what that means. And they called the DOL, and the DOL opened up an investigation. It took 3 years to make them go away.
Oh, geez.
You know, it was, and frankly, we were able to piggyback off of the corrections the SEC required on share classes to make them go on the UL side as well. I've never experienced the Treasury or IRS coming after service providers in that context. That GAO report that recently came out that basically said the IRS should start doing something, and they agreed. I don't know. But at the end of the day, they don't have the infrastructure, and it'll probably take years and a huge budget for that to happen.
That's actually what I was going to mention, is that just a couple of weeks ago, we had a GAO report come out that it looked too coincidental that the rule gets stayed and now this comes out. But it was actually initiated in 2018 when the prior rule was vacated. But it was a bit alarming when it said right in the summary that it laid out the findings that the IRS should proactively audit financial institutions for prohibited transactions in IRAs. And then it said, and the IRS agreed. So again, there's probably quite a bit of ramp up time there if and when that ever happens. But can you imagine yet another regulator with the authority to come in, ask for your books and records and impose penalties? The other thing I would say that we're seeing that hasn't been brought up, one of the channels of financial institutions that we are increasingly serving at PRI are banks and trust companies. And we're seeing, at least in a couple of state bank regulators, OCC has always been really on top of ERISA. In fact, when we bring on junior attorneys, I give them the OCC enforcement manual to understand how it all works. But the state banking regulators asking specifically for PTO 2002 compliance related policies, disclosures, et cetera, in their just routine bank exams. So it's been or a bloodstream is how I would put it at this point. And the policies and procedures requirement, I laid out three requirements earlier that take DOL rules above and beyond the others. But that policies and procedures requirement that's in 2002, that's fair game to any regulator failing to follow your own policies. So it's interesting times, and this is the result when we see rulemaking collide with the courts. There's always a period of uncertainty, but I think the one thing
we had an OCC investigation of a bank, and they picked on the securities lending program, both from an OC and ERISA standpoint, and we had to justify why it worked. Because there, for those who don't know, there's an exemption that applies to SEC lending under ERISA, that if you comply with it, works for IRAs and ERISA plans. And the OC was, they knew they saw things on paper that didn't look right.
Jason Berkowitz, anything to add on the enforcement front before we close up shop here?
Yeah, I think just to cover the SEC side, following the adoption of Reg BI, they had a period of time, about a year, where they were really focused on compliance assistance. They weren't really looking at hardcore enforcement. They were really out trying to do exams to see where there might be deficiencies that would need to be corrected and helping registrants make sure that they were doing things the right way. They have since ramped that up. They are now in a much more robust enforcement phase. The first series of regulatory enforcement proceedings that we saw from the SEC and FINRA really focused on more of the policies and procedures side of things. Some of the disclosures were not quite right. But they were, I would categorize them more as this, as either inadvertent failures of compliance or just lack of awareness failures. Like they just did not, the firm didn't realize that this applied to them. I think we're starting to see now some things popping up that are a little bit more, this was a recommendation not in the client's best interest and it violated the standard. And I think that we'll start to see a little bit more of that going forward as well. But I think what's fascinating is the enforcement experience is so easily manipulated in terms of how it could be used to support one position or the other. If you see a lot of enforcement, that can be a signal that there's lots of bad actors out there and we need these robust rules because there's so many bad guys out there. And if you see enforcement numbers start to tick down, then all of a sudden it's the rules aren't strong enough. We need stronger rules, which is, it's a little bit frustrating, right? If the rules are working the way that they should, you should see enforcement numbers come down, but that's not a great talking point for the, it doesn't get the soundbite treatment that other things do. No. I guess the last thing that I would just say, Patrick, is as firms are thinking about how they want to manage all of this, because there is so much uncertainty, to me, I try to think about it as, are you putting policies and procedures in place and are you requiring your people to operate in a way that if it was their parent was the client, would you feel good about what you were doing? And if you can say with a straight face that if another financial professional did that to my parent, I would be very happy with that, then you can feel pretty good that you're probably in an okay place. Obviously, all the details matter. All of the technicalities matter. You can't ignore that. But at a very high level, starting to build that kind of sense of that culture of compliance that we hear so many regulators talk about. And a lot of times people think about it in terms of the risk of something showing up on the front page of the Times. But I think personalizing it a little bit more for the advisor and talking about it in the context of people that they care about can even be a more powerful way to try to encourage that good behavior. And honestly, I think if the industry could police itself a little bit more effectively, then we would see less pressure from the regulatory community to institute all of these new regulatory requirements. So I'll leave it at that.
I think that's great. And I really appreciate those closing thoughts. And Jason Roberts and David Claydell, I'll give you a chance to offer some closing thoughts here in a moment. But I did want to add just briefly on the enforcement front, and I'll say more so on the, I guess, the examinations part of that. But I've actually seen now in several exams this year from the SEC on the RIA side, so not even on the broker-dealer side, but on the RIA side, they are specifically asking for any of our Department of Labor materials or other things that we provide as it relates to any rollover or related disclosures. And I've seen them ask about our annual review that we do as part of 20-02 and thinking about that. So now, granted, all of these firms, we had been working with them or doing stuff for them, so they had a lot of the relevant documentation. So I don't know, I don't have a whole lot to add of as far as what happens after that part of the process. But again, just something interesting to, as you all have indicated, we are still operating off of the legacy guidance right now. And so firms need to make sure that they're complying with that. But Jason Roberts, closing thoughts from you, and then David Clay will let you wrap things up.
I laugh because Jason's explanation of how to make the world a better place is actually what I use to explain what it is I do to people at a cocktail party. What do? I help financial institutions treat their clients like their grandparents. But as far as takeaways, I mentioned before the former litigator in me shuddering when I saw the requirement come out of 2002 to produce that rollover disclosure, which we call the rollover playback. The other thing that caught me between the eyes, though, is in the connection with the amended 2002. So again, it's not on the books today, but in the amended 2002, firms would have 30 days within which to turn over their, not only their retrospective review, which as it stands right now, that's due within 10 days of request by DOL, but that would have been relaxed to 30, and then there would have been a new requirement to produce your policies and procedures. And what that signaled to me, and there's not any reason to think they can't do the same thing with the retrospective reviews, which they're entitled to request today, is it signals to me a sweep. It's a way to get data points quickly, which is how the DOL investigates, targets investigations around plans. They get all the 5,500 data and they run it through algorithms and so forth. So they use some data to thin the number of firms that they're going to go look at. But if you have retrospective review, you can pretty quickly tell, did that firm know what they're doing? First of all, did they have it? Could they produce it? If they couldn't, that's a big red flag. You're going to go in there and look at that firm. If they have one that looks like they went through the motions, or it's not up to snuff in terms of the DOL's expectations, which they did drop some breadcrumbs in the preamble to the amended 2002, particularly the proposal, where they said something to the effect of, we expect you to be testing compliance with each of the conditions, which fortunately, that's how we laid out our template for our clients. But I don't know that a lot of firms took that approach. They took a higher, from what I can see, a lot of firms took a much higher level approach to that report. And I would say be judicious about what goes in that report. Put in there just enough to show that you tested compliance with each of the conditions, but don't feel compelled to go out of the way and include anything else, because in my mind, it's just like policies and procedures. That's the stuff that then comes back to haunt you.
Sure.
Say, closing thoughts would be, dust off that retrospective review, make sure that as I anticipate the DOL pivots from spending energy focused on rulemaking to enforcement, make sure that the grace period for the original 2002 is, I think that's come and gone.
I can
easily see a request for retrospective reviews then being funneled into a triage, and these are the firms we're going to go look at because they're outliers in some form or fashion.
Thanks, Jason. David?
Yeah, I think the DOL is committed to this regulatory effort as well as enforcement in this area. The one thing we didn't talk about, I'm not going to go into the detail, the one thing that could change their course is who wins the election. That could have an impact here on how aggressively they want to pursue appeals and things like that, as happened back in 2018-19. But I think just at the end of the day is, remember, the IRAs, HSAs, Coverdells, Archers, medical savings accounts, and ERISA covered plans have always been subject to this regime. I think people seem to sometimes forget that, particularly in the IRA space, they've always been subject to the prohibited transaction. If you're making recommendations to invest or discretionary decisions to invest in proprietary products, or if you're getting third-party payments, that all gave rise to these prohibited transaction issues. The good news is that we do have these exemptions, 2002, but 8424, now that it's the amendment doesn't apply, that's a great exemption. So if you're on the insurance side, and you think there's some risk, I would use 8424 in a heartbeat. And there are a number of other exemptions that financial services firms can and have used for years. That's something to think about as well. But the important thing is, as we've started off saying, and we're going to end saying, is all this stuff still applies and you still have to comply with the rules. This recent activity doesn't change that.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I can definitely say that your insights today have been incredibly valuable and certainly helpful for me, and I hope all of our listeners, to get a better sense of not only what's happening out there right now, but also certainly some best practices and key takeaways that they can take with them as they're thinking about how to make sure that when they're dealing with their retirement investors, and then when they think about the types of activities that they are involved in, to making sure that they're staying on the right side of the fence there. Thank you all so much for being so generous with your time and for coming on the show today. I know we've had a really robust discussion. I ran even a little bit over time, but I'm not going to let you get away that easy. We do typically like to end these shows with something a little bit more lighthearted and fun than maybe all the technicalities of ERISA. My softball question for all three of you today is, look, I know in the Hayes household, right, we are heavy into the fall season game right now. Pumpkin patches and Halloween and other stuff coming up. But for each of the three of you, what is your favorite fall activity? Or maybe another way to frame that, if it's easier to answer, what are you most looking forward to doing this fall? We'll start in my order of the boxes here. So we'll go with Jason Berkowitz.
So I have been a Denver Broncos fan for about 30 plus years, which surprises people because they know I grew up in New York. But in all that time, I have only seen them play on the road. I've never actually seen them in their own stadium. And so I actually have the opportunity to go out to Denver in November. A big thank you to the NAIC for scheduling their fall meeting to align with the home game. And I'm actually flying one of my sons out to join me. So we're going to go check that out. We're really excited about it. Awesome. And all the games we've seen so far with the Broncos on the road, the home team is one, so I'm hoping that pattern continues.
Thanks, Jason. That's awesome. Mr. Roberts.
I would have said the Chiefs game that I'm going to go to when I go back.
We can still be friends, Jason.
I'll pivot knowing that we have a Broncos fan in the house. So I have a 4-year-old and a soon-to-be 3-year-old, and they love to go back and trick-or-treat with their cousins in the same hometown where I grew up. And I'm looking forward to shepherding all the kids down Main Street in their different outfits.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm gearing up because I may or may not be getting asked to go as the dad from Bluey this year, which just seems like it's going to be really hot, given the amount of costume that would be included in that disguise. So we can maybe digest and debrief about our experiences later, Jason Roberts. How about you, David?
A couple things. One is I married into an Ohio State family, so I know that upsets like the guy with the Notre Dame shirt in front of me and as well as the Michigan people on the line and everybody else in the Big Ten. But I've been indoctrinated in the last 25 years, so I very much look forward to seeing those games and hopefully a better outcome this year. I'm going to enjoy the cooler weather. I like riding my bike, and it's a lot easier to do that in D.C. when it's not gross out. And then finally, my daughter is a senior in high school, and she's applying to colleges, and I'm hoping by January 1 we'll be done with this process because it's pretty darn stressful. So I'm looking forward to getting that over with this week.
I tell you what, this is a rock solid list from all three of you. You did a great, these are really good. And not only are they like fun things, most of them, but also probably some things that can help motivate you to get to the other side too. So that's great. But look, I greatly appreciate all three of you coming on today. It has really been a pleasure having you to talk about such an important topic for so many of our listeners. Thank you again. Have a great rest of your day and looking forward to having you back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Jason Berkowitz, David Kaleda, and Jason Roberts, for coming on the show today to share their fantastic insights on the current state of the DOL fiduciary rule and other best practices firms should have in place regarding investment recommendations being made and other services provided to retirement investors. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.